So yeah, we're going to be talking about some of the lessons that we've learned over the last, I'd say probably 10, 15 years. Really hoping to provide some information and some knowledge that people can take away and apply to their infrastructures. You can think about this as sort of a distilled version of John's talk that he gave just before this, for those of you who are here. His talk was great. He focused on where Twitter is now and the sort of high level of where they got there. We're going to be focusing on the first sort of 6 to 12 months of a startup's life and the important things to think about when your infrastructure is really young. So we'll get on with that. First though, I have a little warning for everyone here. This is Mark Zuckerberg. He's pretty awesome. He built something great, but we can't help you be him. He uses Emacs. We just don't know Emacs. We're Vim guys. But if you want to learn about his stuff, it's next door, so you can go over there. That way, it's over there. But if you want to take your company from this to something like this, maybe you can't see that very well, but it's a very neat row of racks in a data center over there, then you should keep listening. All right, so getting your infrastructure started right, and not just preparing for instant and rapid event responses and firefighting. The thing you really don't want to do is be fighting fires. So I mentioned who we are. I can just probably skip through that. We'll be talking about a number of different things here. Workflow is actually very important, and it's kind of a boring thing to talk about. No one really likes to talk about what's your workflow like, how do you handle tickets. But it's one of the key things that will really help you when you're building out your infrastructure, if not actually, I think, the key thing to think about. It's very important when it comes to consistency and something never to cut corners on. Like I said, people traditionally don't spend a lot of time doing their planning and thinking about how they want to move forward. I usually spend about 50% of my time whenever I'm faced with a problem thinking about how I'm going to implement it and what kind of impact it'll have a few months down the line. Software choices play an important role as well. In a small infrastructure, especially when you're really starting out, things become legacy very quickly and get in the way. So we'll go into a little bit about that and how it affects things like technical debt and premature optimization. And then finally, we'll get into the really juicy bits of how to set up your infrastructure and manage it. Okay, so I work at Etsy. We were founded in 2005. We have a very busy website, 6 million? Yep, 6 million active users, fairly well funded. We've been going through some pretty rapid growth. And a lot of the things that I'm talking about now, we're finding still apply quite directly, even after so many years of doing it, because what we're using now will hopefully be small compared to what we're using in 3 to 5 years' time. So it goes forward. Wumio started in 2007, also experienced very rapid growth. Number of servers have doubled every sort of 3 to 6 months, which anyone who's gone through that kind of growth will know that after a while, it gets pretty crazy. All right, so straight on with workflow. Tickets are your friend. A lot of people don't like dealing with tickets. I've got too many tickets. My queue's too big. Don't be afraid of tickets. Please embrace them. It's much better to have a very large queue that you're never going to get through than to forget what you need to do. So use any ticket system you like. I do encourage people to be tool agnostic, be language agnostic, but actually use a tool, use something that will help you with this. The next thing is don't repeat yourself. I'm sure a lot of people already use this, but I think it's important to mention again. Oops, sorry. Don't repeat yourself. Don't repeat yourself. I'm sure a lot of people, Don't just pay lip service to that. It is very, very important. Again, it is something when you're writing your tools, as you invariably will do, it will save you a lot of time if you can remember that. The little bit of uncommon knowledge at all the places I've worked, there's so many places that do not put all of their configurations, all of their tools, everything they use on a daily basis into some kind of version control system. SVN, Mercurial, Git, whatever you want, the value of having that in there is extremely high. It enables you to replicate your tools across your entire infrastructure very quickly. Be sure that you're using the same tools consistently everywhere. It's something that we really should be doing. Yes, the fail whale has suffered a small accident there. Everything you do will change very quickly in a small infrastructure. Don't get hung up on what you're doing. Things will change an awful lot. And this is probably the best time to talk about technical debt and premature optimization. Technical debt, for those of you who haven't heard the term, describes doing something now and incurring a cost for it later on. For example, you set up a simple database schema now to manage something, and it results, and you know that it's going to result in you having to redo all of the work in a month or 2 months or 3 months. In most companies, once you're set up and established, incurring technical debt can be very, very expensive. But realizing that you're going to throw away most of the stuff you've done in the first 3 months after a year, or even sooner, sometimes after three to six more months, it lets you realize that technical debt is not necessarily a bad thing. You can absorb it and you can deal with it later because you're going to have to anyway. So doing premature optimizations on every little thing you do will hurt you and just slow down your progress. Let's see. So hiring is very important, of course, for anyone who's worked at a small company. If you don't get along with most of the people there, it gets kind of awkward to have to deal with even daily things like, hey, are you working on this tool? Or are you working on this? Or are you going to deal with this problem? How are you going to do that? So pay attention to hiring. It's a good thing to do. Speed is a very much encouraged thing. At Etsy, we sometimes do more than 12 releases in a day, 5 days a week. And we have an entire infrastructure set up to support this. And if you're going to be the first ones to market with whatever product you're using, or if you're already on the market and you want to be better than everybody else and you want to rapidly evolve your product, you really need to be able to do very fast releases, move very fast in your infrastructure. And going along with that, it's okay to make mistakes. It's harder to make mistakes when you're a big giant company, for example, like Twitter or Google, and you take your site down for, you know, even an hour. A lot of people will notice. But when you're small, it's okay to make mistakes, learn from them early on, accept that they will happen, and then just move on from those. Okay, team communication. And I think this kind of goes without saying for almost everyone here. People like to, as sysadmins, we like tools like IRC. A lot of us like to stay in contact with each other. It's a little harder to spread that into an entire organization. At Etsy, we have pretty much everybody in the company using IRC internally, and that is one of our primary methods of communication. Wumi uses Skype. Again, another fine tool. And it doesn't really matter what tool you're using, as long as you are communicating. Over-communicating this way is much, much better than under-communicating and missing out on information. That doesn't mean have more meetings. No one wants more meetings. Do communicate, send emails out, and all this kind of stuff. Okay. All right, on to some more juicy stuff. The first rule of building out your infrastructure is layers. It's hard, again, when you're small, trying to get funds for setting up, more servers and things. You can take advantage of tricks like virtualization, but really separate out as many of the layers of your system that you can. Work with your developers to enable this. They may not want to right away. They may have other deadlines and things to press on with. But having this come in early is going to save you a lot of headaches later on. And a lot of these things are not very difficult to do. Software choice needs to focus on fast deployments, ease of use, and ease of configuration. And again, as I mentioned, I'm pretty much tool agnostic. Some people like, for example, Apache. Some people like Nginx. Some people like Lighty. It doesn't really matter what tool you're doing. As long as you have the expertise for it already, if it's something that you know, just go with it. Take it, run, and get it out the door. I like to say leave your religion at the door. Just be agnostic with what you're doing. Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Etsy's deployment method. As I mentioned, we do sometimes 12 or more releases in one day. In a lot of organizations, the ops people are responsible for doing the deployments, getting code out there, monitoring it, making sure it's okay, and then moving on to the next bit of work. At Etsy, we've kind of flipped that on its head a little bit. We are, like the guys at Twitter and a lot of other companies, very strong proponents of the DevOps idea, where developers and operations work very, very closely together. And we actually have our developers doing their deployments. We wrote a tool called Deploynator, which ties in continuous integration testing and lets developers just, you know, do the push whenever they're ready. It also enables very fast rollbacks. The entire process is automated. A developer will go provide a commit revision, and it'll be tested and pushed out when it's ready. And based on the back of that, then, you know, we again integrated dashboards and graphing and things to see when there are problems and when they're related to deployments. So script your deployments and your rollbacks, make them quick. These are the things you want to spend probably the least amount of time on when you're dealing with your infrastructure. You really don't want it to get in the way. And we'll talk a little bit now about sort of the mean time to resolution versus mean time between failures. A really good picture here I like. This was Arthur Bergman posted this a while ago, comparing Jeeps and Rolls-Royce. Jeeps like to get the snot beaten out of them. They are run over uneven land, they're driven roughly, and they have a very, very, very short mean time to repair. You can strip down a Jeep to its bare components and put it back together in under 3 minutes. And if anyone hasn't seen the video for that, it's pretty cool. Find it on YouTube. Whereas if you take a look at the Rolls-Royce model, it can take weeks or sometimes even longer to repair a Rolls-Royce. But the alternative is that it doesn't break very often. They're driven in a you know, sort of a lot calmer way. And it's okay for those to be out of service for a long time. It's not okay for your infrastructure to be out of service for a long time, like a Rolls-Royce. So treat your infrastructure more like a Jeep. You know, kick it around, it's gonna get beaten up, it's gonna be rough, but that's okay, because as long as something breaks and you can fix it within seconds or minutes rather than hours, it'll run much better. All right, so logging. My favorite tool of choice right now is SysLogNG. I know a lot of people are looking at things like Scribe, and they want to move in that sort of direction, but for the most part, SysLogNG is great. You can have it, you know, read log files off disk. You can have it take input from wherever, send it centrally, and then move on to the secret weapon. This is something that we discovered when I was working at Wumi with Mark about a year ago, is that having your web logs, if you're a web applications company, having your web logs in a database where you can search them, for example, with SQL or through Splunk or through some other tools, is really, really important. And it's something that not many people think about initially. But it enables you to do some really, really cool things, which I'll get into in a moment. So this is sort of the very simple database schema that I used to set this up. And all it's doing, really, you can see, if you take an Apache log file, just splitting up all the fields and just putting them into a database. Lets you search on all kinds of really good stuff. You can find when certain pages are being slow. You can tie it into when you did a release. You can see if there's an increase in errors in a certain place or not. This is a graph that we had for the number of 504 errors that were returned by various backend servers. And it looks kind of high. We're going over 500 504 errors in a 5 minute window. But this kind of thing lets you identify when problems started and then tie them back, which is a lot harder to do when you aren't really data mining all of your logs. And that goes in with the next thing, which is alerting versus trend analysis. Typical Nagios, everyone loves it, it's great. Just does its job. It's good for alerting, but it's really, really bad for trend analysis that we want to do, that I showed you a moment ago with the RRD screenshot. This is Ganglia. A lot of people are moving towards this kind of thing for getting more real-time statistics on their infrastructure. It's just about as easy to script for is something in Nagios, but it'll give you much more rapid responses and more real-time data to look for. And that's really great for analyzing trends and finding when things change. And being able to see over the long term how your database load is growing and how your web server load is going, where your traffic's going, and being able to graph that is good. So what should you monitor? My rule for monitoring is anything that breaks once will break again. So stick a monitor on it. Don't wait for it to break a second time and wake you up and somebody's saying the site's down. Breaks once, monitor it. And especially it goes for customer-facing services. A lot of people do ask me, well, we're setting up all this stuff and we've got Nagios going and it's great. And then I ask them, well, are you monitoring how many registrations you have coming in per day? Well, no, we've got to do that. All right, well, are you monitoring how many emails your servers are sending out? Oh, no, we've got to do that too. So don't just think about the individual hosts and the Unix level stuff. Really tie it in with the applications that your developers are working on and get statistics out of them. Ask them for counters. Ask them for anything you can measure. And then stick an alert on it. And it goes the other way, too. Everything that moves, graph it. Everything. If there's a number, if there's a counter somewhere that you find, stick a graph on it. Because at some point later on down the road, you'll want to know how that trended over the last 6 months. And again, customer-facing rates and statistics and things. How many users do you have joining your site? How many messages are you sending out? All that good stuff. And data is only useful when you can distill the key data from it. And good targets for these are things like database logs. MySQL, you can get Matkit, which has MK Query Digest. Postgres has a wonderful tool that someone's written for it, pgfuin, which tells you, how your databases are performing. And there's an interesting thing when you're looking at database performance specifically, and Mark's going to talk about this. A lot of people know, hey, if I have a database and it's behaving badly, I should probably go look at the slowest queries that are running on it. Very easy to do. You can just log into your database, show me the current process list. What queries are being executed right now? Oh, this one's running for 4 minutes. That's a little strange. Ah, it's missing an index. Fixed. That's sort of a very easy thing and very obvious thing that a lot of people do already do. The thing that people don't do in my experience is then look at which queries am I executing overall? Which queries are the fastest ones that I'm executing, but they're being executed 100 times more than any other query? And that's one of the things you'll find will, for example, kill your database. So you really have to use tools like this which analyze your entire traffic and then show you what's going on with it. Okay, and this is, just to illustrate that point a little more, this is this was taken using Moonin, which is a wonderful tool, has some limitations. I prefer Ganglia, as I mentioned earlier. But if you take a look at the blue graph at the bottom for the amount of time a Postgres database spent using CPU, there are some clear dips. If you look at March, there was a big drop down. If you look again at April, there's another big drop down followed by a jump, and then finally settled down around June. At each of those points, we took a look at not what were the slowest queries, but which were the ones that were really hurting the database, which ones were being executed, like I said, 100 times more than any others because there was some code that wasn't optimized. Which ones were really dragging down the actual CPU utilization, not just running for minutes and minutes on end. Don't work yourself into a position where you depend on your caching layer being up 100%. The Twitter guys do it. They said they have a read-only mode when they need to just focus on fixing their writes and so on. But your cache is supposed to be very disposable. If it goes away, it goes away. You should be able to rebuild it at any time. And when you can't, it'll get very painful. Okay. Thundering Herd. What about the Thundering Herd? Well, let's talk about the Thundering Herd a little bit. This is a picture of the northeast seaboard. It's a little dark. The northeastern seaboard of the US on August the 13th, 2003. This is August the 14th, 2003. Some people may realize this was a huge blackout that happened in 2003. And it was really caused by a lack of capacity planning and a lack of proper procedure following. It started very small. One power line in the middle of nowhere sagged down a little more than it should have, rushed into a tree that shouldn't have been there, caught on fire, and resulted in a huge cascading effect that took down power to a lot of places. But even with that happening, the power companies had a system in place that really worked to stop the thundering herd destroying the entire infrastructure. Most people don't realize this, but of all the power stations that went offline during this outage, 85% of them happened after each power station disconnected from the local grid. It was purely a protective measure to stop the power station from melting down. They didn't have to go offline. They could have actually been online and quite all right. But there was measures in place to stop the thundering herd from destroying everything. And in this case, just being down for a little while turned out to be okay, better than having to rebuild 256 power stations. So on the back of that, make sure your back-end capacity when you're building out your caching infrastructure is also up to spec. If you have 50 memcache servers, I don't know anyone who does, but maybe somebody does. If you have 50 memcache servers, make sure your back-end can support load if they go away. Some people may remember that after 9/11, a lot of news organizations found their sites crashing and going down. And one of the main reasons for that is, well, there are two main reasons for that. One of them primarily was that their caching infrastructure fell over and their backends were not able to keep up with the massive amount of load. CNN fixed this in a pretty novel way such that when their infrastructure starts to fall down, their site will degrade very gracefully down to a very basic site until their load levels drop. So keep those kinds of things in mind when you're dealing with caching and your database layers. Find out how your caching software works. John talked about this a little bit this morning. He mentioned Memcache and Peep to analyze how your data is being stored in Memcache. That's very important to do. But just on a general scale, is it better to store a lot of keys and small numbers of objects in whatever caching mechanism you're using, or is it better to have fewer keys and very large objects so that you can return a large amount of data at once? And really that depends on what tools you're doing, but it's an important bit of analysis to do and to think about. And again, that goes into like how is the memory allocated by your caching mechanism. So we can easily solve the cache as our disposable problem. It's not too difficult. We can solve the thundering herd problem. Again, not too difficult. Now it's time to get into the fun database things, and that'll be over to Mark.
Hello, everyone. So databases, or hopefully fun data interesting. It's a very difficult thing to do, to master your databases right. The first thing you need to do is decide which kind of database you want to run. Do you want to run NoSQL? Do you want to run SQL? It really depends on what you want to do with your data. There's lots of bias lately about NoSQL and SQL as well. So it's a bit difficult to take that decision. Sometimes the decision won't really be in your hands, since if the application layer you're using only works on SQL, well, the decision is made for you there. So at WIMI, we're using both. We're using SQL for most of our data. SQL, because SQL is very good at enforcing rules that ensure that your data makes sense, which NoSQL is not so good at. So you really need to have extra software implementation for that, which we choose really not to. And we use NoSQL for inconsistent data. Could be your user sessions, temporary tables, or even when you're doing real-time actions, sometimes you don't want to write that immediately into database until you're really sure that this action has finally happened and it's not rolled back. So NoSQL is very good at storing lots of information very fast. Some people actually use some versions of NoSQL like Redis to replace memcached, for example, or the caches that are out there, because it's so fast writing that, and it also gives you the ability to recover your information in case of a machine crash. So it's a very good option for that, and we've been looking at that actually. But mainly, we're using our WIMI Postgres, which is a very robust open source database, and we're very happy with it. So you have most people start with some tables, let's say 5, 10, 20 tables, and then they start adding stuff after that. And they just add stuff as they need to. That's what we call organic growth. Letting your database to grow organically, it's a very big mistake. We've all gone through that. It doesn't really pay back later. So you have to be really careful about how you grow your database. Growing organically can lead you to a very big technical debt, and changing your database later, depending on which components, is very difficult. One good example is that at WIMI we had a database that completely changed its behavior from one day to the next, because we decided to add some indexes that would make things faster. At the end, they made it slower. So it's always good to double check what you're doing. So as you can see, spending time on designing a good database is always good paid time. And that actually is not my database, but it looks very cool. All right. One good thing that you can do is use many-to-many tables. When you have different pieces and components in your database, many-to-many tables can help you connect this different information easily, but this can result in a big kerfuffle at the end. So you have to be careful about your M2M tables. They're very useful, but they will bite you back badly. So at the end, you will basically get it wrong. And it's fine. We all get it wrong. But you have to learn from that. As Lynn said, you have to learn from your mistakes. And you have to be at peace that you will basically crash your database and you do things that you shouldn't. The thing you have to do is be smart about it. And if you put before you have these mistakes, you put the things in place that you need, it will be very easy later to correct. For example, we have a very big table for messaging at WIMI, and we joined that with an M2M table that resulted in being a very horrible problem. And we had queries that lasted up to 60 seconds, and as you know, anything that is over 5 seconds, it's not really useful to the user, since if it takes you longer than that, the user will be gone by then. So what we decided is like spend a couple of weeks redesigning that, and we got these queries from over 60 seconds to under 1 second. So it was good until it broke, but then we just spent some time fixing it, and now it's fast again. All right. The read dilemma. It's reading from a database, it's normally not difficult up to a certain level. When you start having very big sets of data, you will start incurring into some problems. One solution that everyone will try to do is to add lots of indexes to the table. We had a case of one developer that added an index to every single column of a table, which resulted in having a very slow table. So you have to be smart about your indexes, because you are paying in memory for being fast. So be sure that you put as many indexes as you need, but not more. Okay, also another good thing is to check for slow queries. Optimize always using your indexes. Any kind of reporting to do about slow queries is always good. Also, if you use SQL, a very good way to make your data consistent is to check to have foreign keys in place. foreign keys are very good to making sure that all your data is the way it should be. But when you arrive to a certain level of transactions, they will start killing you badly. So have foreign keys in place, but sometimes you have to let that consistency go a little bit, remove some of them. So when you grow very big on your data, you want to start partitioning that data. You want to start sharding, or you want to start making partitions, as we do at Wimi. It really depends on how you have your data. There's data you can partition, and there's data you can't. So you have set different options for you. We use partitioning by date at Wimi in order to have data that shouldn't be all on the same table, just divided in several days and weeks. And at the end, some of the data we can even remove in time. The most important thing about databases is this guy. A good database should have lots of memory, because the more memory you have, the less you will access the disk. But even with us, this guy is always one of the bigger concerns. It's very important, and I think it's actually good to have good monitoring in place, even if your database is very small, about this guy, because it will always be your first problem. And even if you, at the beginning, you see you have a bit too high this guy, don't try to optimize that before time. As I said, optimize when you need, not don't optimize early, because then you will incur in problems. So one thing we did at Wimi in order to do that is to divide our writes. We segmented our database into different components called replication sets. Each replication set has a set of tables. And then what we did is that superseded the relations. Instead of having relations between tables, we have relations between replication sets. So we know that for having the message application, we need all the message tables, but also we need the user data tables. We're using Londisti to replicate between our different Postgres servers, which ensures that all the information is in all databases in less than 2 seconds, which for us is good enough. I mean, for what we're doing, 2 seconds, it's not a dramatic change. Some of the people maybe have some of the problems, and they need data faster. But unless you are something as big as Twitter or something as real time, most of the time 2 seconds is okay. Also, another very interesting thing to do from the beginning is that if you start having more than one database, it's good to virtualize the way you're connecting to those databases. We use PG Bouncer at Wimi for doing that, as the Twitter guys use Gizzard as well. It's a very good way to have your all databases viewable from each server, so you don't have to manually configure it and jump from one to the other. You just go on like, I need this table, I need this resource, give it to me now. So apart from that, another very important thing is your web front end. That's what the users will see. So this is the first thing that will fail, and that your users will run away from you if that happens. The best thing would be to just throw dollars at it and get a Harvard load balancer. But it's very expensive, especially if you're a small startup. You don't want to start spending big dollars on F5 and other hardware like that. So you can use software balancers. And this a very big choice of software balancers for you. So you can, depending on what you need, you can either use a web load balancer, you can use Apache with ModProxy, or Nginx, or even Lighty. And each one of them will give you some advantage over the other. Like Apache will be good for you if you're running PHP code. Nginx is a very good, almost real-time balancer. But they don't give you some advantages that reverse proxies will give to you. If you have a reverse proxy at hand, it will cache some of the information. So if you have lots of pages that are not created in real time, or are created in real time but they don't change that much, you can take some advantage out of having a reverse proxy in front of your platform. Or even using both methods, have a load balancer using, for example, Apache and having a varnish in front of Apache in order to cache the information. And if you want to go really nifty and use something very similar to what a hardware balancer does, you can use a kernel load balancer like the Linux IPVS project, which works very well. It's a very cheap way to have a hardware load balancer almost. So we use Nginx at Wimi for balancing stuff just because we are a Python house. We don't use PHP, so we don't need to compile data inside an Apache, something like that. So we can just throw everything directly to Python instances using Nginx, and it's very useful for us. It's giving us on the second performance.
Okay.
All right. So I said reverse proxies. Catching stuff is good for you, but it really depends on what you're doing in your web. If you have some web like Facebook where you're updating all your stuff in real time, reverse proxying gives you a very small advantage versus just having directly Nginx or Apache. But if you have something like a HOTL search and you have all the HOTL page that are static most of the time, a reverse proxy will be your lifesaver. Okay. As soon as you start growing, you will start with just one cluster of web servers for everything. As soon as you start growing, it's a good idea to start dividing that the same way big websites do. This way, if something breaks, you can contain it, and also you can start growing like a tree. You can have different web clusters and have your application segmented, which also gives you a big advantage for maintenance. If you want to maintain just one part of the platform, you shut down that part of the service, have a nice error page showing, and this will give you also for more flexibility. So another thing that will help you grow up very fast is to use automation tools. Choose your own one. There's lots of them around. There's CF Engine that Facebook is using. There's Puppet. There's also Chef, which is very popular lately. Any of them will give you two very important things. The first of all is that any new machine that you install, you can get it in service very fast, because you will script all the things that you need on that machine, and you just need to tell your automation tool that this machine will be a web server, this machine will be an application server or a database, and you can have a new machine in under 10 minutes. Right now, Wimi, we can get a new machine running in under 7 minutes, and we're trying very hard to go beyond that, maybe 5 minutes. It also will help you to maintain stability across all the platform. Especially if, as in our case, you give your developers access to your production platform. Developers like to touch stuff and fix it in real time, which sometimes results in having some of your application servers with one version of something and some others with another version, which is not really good for a sysadmin. We want to have everything under control and have everything working the same way. So in our case, Puppet will help you maintain everything the way it should be, and if something gets touched, it gets recovered to its previous state in under 5 minutes. It will also help you upgrade your platform very fast. We have different Python modules, and we have different Apache servers, etc. And every time we want to upgrade anything, we just feed it through Puppet, and in less than 5 minutes, we have a new version live, which for us is a big advantage. Writing tools. It is part of life as a sysadmin always to be writing all kinds of very small tools to help you add to what you have and to help you deal with any problem. As Evelyn said, if you're doing something more than once and you keep doing it, write a tool for doing it. Because automation of any task that is monotonous or repetitive, it will always be more time for you to do cool stuff. So it's sometimes it's good, and I always say it's very good to be a lazy sysadmin, which means that you will always try to get everything under control as fast as you can. Writing these tools sometimes can end up with having a script that calls another script that calls another script. There was one time that our CTO started shouting at us because he wanted to touch our tools. He's like, oh, you're having an array of infinite array of bash scripts. What's that? So it's useful, and it's also kind of the way Unix goes to, which kind of helps. It's always useful. Don't diversify your scripts too much. Even if you find something that works in Perl very, very well and you have this amazing function, but if you're the only one that knows Perl and all the rest of your colleagues know Python and Bash, try to stick to that. Otherwise, you'll end up having a big amount of tools that depend on one tool that nobody else knows to fix except you. And you don't really want to be called in the middle of the night because somebody's trying to fix that. A very good thing that you can do, use a versioning system for your tools. We use Mercurial at Wumi, and what we do is that anytime we change anything on any of the machines, we just push it back to a central repo, and it gets distributed amongst all the servers. So we can have all the tools up to date in all the servers we're working at the same time. And it's once you get into this level of consistency, it starts to build up. You can start to have stuff that depends on you having all these scripts in all places, and it starts to do some very cool stuff. Like we have pgbouncer configured like that, so anytime we need a pgbouncer configuration change, we just push the new version out, and we just let Puppet refresh all pgbouncer for us. So it helps you to advance very fast in any change you want to make. And even offlining the site, for Wumi, offlining the site is a work of 2 minutes. In under 2 minutes, you can have everything stopped, and you can do a database upgrade, or you can do a big component upgrade that you need to. So backups. Backups are very important. We all know we've all been into a situation where we didn't have the backup we needed. Backups, though, shouldn't be the plan B. You should have a plan B that doesn't depend on backups, because even if you try very hard, backups will fail. So let's say backups should be your plan C. Always have a plan B in mind. A good way also to ensure that your backups are good is to exercise them. We do so at Wumi. We always, every week, we do a simulation of restoring our whole infrastructure from our data, or from our backups. And this is a very good way to know when you're actually getting something wrong. And it helps you not having to deal with that problem later in time. So how we can exercise these backups? Let's say you're a very small startup. You have just enough money for maintaining all your servers. How can you tell your boss, I need 10 more servers to just exercise my backups and don't use them for anything else? He will just shout at you and tell you that you're crazy. So what we do in that is that we use cloud computing. Some of the people use cloud computing to lower their resources and their expenses. We use cloud computing for our backups. We're cool. So what we do is that we push all backups into the cloud. We're using Amazon EC2 for that. And we have a set of scripts that every week refresh all backups and restore all the information from Wumi into a cloud system. So we can just go there, navigate as if it was our own website, and see if everything's wrong, or something has changed, or we're missing some component that is important on those backups. So it's very important. Have always your safety methods there. Cloud computing, or we also could use cloud computing. We never had this situation yet, but since we're already moving all backups over there, we can also use the cloud to face a very big wave of traffic. Let's say that suddenly Slashdot, Dig, on Reddit all at the same time say that we are called to visit, and then we go from having 4,000 visits to having 50,000. We can just spawn more instances on the cloud and start redirecting back all for traffic over there, which helps. If you get into that kind of volume, though, it's always good to either ask for more money or for more pizza. So, some things that you can read to extend what we've been talking here. You can read what's DevOps on Wikipedia. DevOps is the new cool word that everyone is using. I won't use that because it's cool. So you can read the definition there. If you want to read more about capacity planning, there's one of the Etsy guys that maintains a very good blog about it. It's a very recommended read. And also high scalability, which is the reference page for web scaling. And if you're into a SQL nerd, as I am, there's a very good site. It's called Explain Extended. It goes very in depth into SQL and how to solve some of the problems we're having. So that's it. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, now's the time.
Hi, I'm Jay from Rackspace. I'm just curious to what size y'all have scaled to. Do you have any metrics on, you know, server numbers or hits or anything of that nature?
Yes. So Wumi, we scaled from a small number. When I started at Wumi, I think we had about 10 boxes. And in 2 years, we scaled that to about 100 boxes. So in the grand scheme of things, you know, certainly not the Facebook scale or the Twitter scale, but the point was to illustrate that we can do rapid growth. So that Etsy has grown at an even faster pace than that. I don't know if I have exact metrics on how many hits we're getting, but for example, you know, Etsy has 6 million active users, and when we say active, we mean users who are regularly coming to the site, looking at what's there. You know, some of them are buying things, rather than just a total number of accounts that we have. So you can base, like, you know, 6 million people going to a site, you probably, you know, we get a lot of hits. And on that, we have, on the back of that, again, in the numbers, the server numbers are, I believe, in the low hundreds now.
Doug Hughes, DE Shaw Research. I don't know if you're familiar with Michael Stonebreaker. He's sort of like one of the acknowledged database experts in the world.
Yeah.
He made an interesting point in some papers he's published, that really it's not about SQL versus no SQL. That's sort of the false dichotomy, and I'd like to, you know, I think he has a point, and we should encourage people not to make that choice. We should be comparing a traditional transactional database versus a non-transactional database, because the language that you're using, SQL, is just a language. It doesn't have to have transactional consistency if you don't want it to. It's just that the implementations that we're using today have that in them.
Right. And I completely agree. And this is, I think, one of the points that Mark was trying to illustrate, is that, you know, we're working towards a place where some people are, you know, very adamantly in the traditional transactional model, and some people are very heavily favoring, you know, moving towards the, I'll say no SQL, but the, you know, the
right,
key value based systems. And, you know, there's no reason you can't actually have, you know, transactional setups with
an API.
Yeah, exactly. But the point is more that, you know, there's certainly more than one way of doing it, and sometimes
right,
you end up doing it both ways at the same time.
Yeah.
And you really should be looking at the tools that you're being given, or, you know, that are available to you, and really look at the model that your data requires. So if your data requires, for example, you know, a model where you are dealing with a lot of payments, you know, myself, I would probably go with a transactional model, probably go with a traditional relational database, something like that. But the more important thing than picking, for example, MySQL versus Cassandra versus whatever, is what tools do you have to support that? You know, if you need to recover it, how quickly can you recover your database? Can you do it in an hour? Can you do it in a day? You know, will your site be down? What functionality will be impacted? And really develop the tools around it to really support what your business requires, rather than just focusing on, you know, for example, oh, well, I just set up the database software.
Right.
So, thank you.
Duncan Hussey, Carnegie Mellon University. Aveline, at the beginning you talked about premature optimization versus technical debt.
Mm-hmm.
You could phrase that with a similar idea in a slightly less loaded way by calling it getting it done or getting it out the door versus doing it right the first time.
Yeah.
So you could look at it as a particular sort of potential optimization, and it will lie somewhere on the continuum of whether it's worth doing or not. Do you have any comments about how to determine when it's premature optimization and when it's timely optimization?
Right. It's a very tricky problem to solve, and it really, you know, like you're saying, it will depend on a case-by-case basis. How do you determine that? I'll let you know when I figure it out. It's I just end up usually looking at the piece of work that I'm doing and thinking about how long that tool or that code or whatever it is, how long will that be around? If it's going to be something that's around for, if it's going to be something that's around for years, then it's probably better to put in a little bit of thought now. For example, I developed one of the initial release processes at WUMI, and that was about 2 years ago, and it's still in place now. And I had a feeling that once that was out there, that wasn't really going away or going to be changed very quickly. So I built in a little bit of extra functionality. Instead of getting it out in 3 days, I think I took about a week. So it was 2 days worth of extra time, but with the knowledge that this is going to be around for a long time. At the same time, I've set up numerous graphs and metrics that people have told me, well, these will only be in place for about a month before we change them. So instead of spending days getting the numbers right and making sure it's all okay, I spend a couple of hours getting a graph together and then just walking away and focusing on something else. So it really, you have to look at how long you think your work will actually stay in place. And keeping in mind that, a lot of times once something is in place, it's going to be there for a while. Unless you're certain that it's actually going to just disappear at some point, it can be beneficial to spend a little bit more time sort of doing timely optimization. So does that sort of answer? Okay. Any other questions?
Great. If there are no more questions, I think we're done. Thank you very much for speaking to us this afternoon.
Cool. Thank you.